It's the 25th of January on ABC Radio National. Of course, that's the day before Independence Day in India and Australia Day in this country. But it's the 25th of January, which is a special day in one particular country and in many other places around the world too, because it's the birthday of Scotland's national bard, Robert Burns. And today marks the 225th anniversary of the Burns Supper, an annual celebration of everything Robert Burns. Ahead of our own Burns Supper celebrations this evening, we're joined now by Pauline McKay, Professor of Robert Burns Studies and Cultural Heritage at the University of Glasgow. And if you'll be holding a Burns Supper celebration tonight, stay tuned, because Pauline wants you to be part of a global project that she's running. But first, welcome, Pauline, and happy Burns Day.
Thank you very much. Lovely to meet you.
You too. Now, Robert Burns, obviously a huge figure in Scotland and someone who sadly had a relatively short life. For those who might not be Burns aficionados, could you just tell us a little bit about the man and his life and impact?
So Robert Burns is, of course, the Scottish National Bard. He was born in Alloway, Ayrshire, on the 25th of January, 1759, a farmer's son. However, he was an incredibly talented writer, and he produced hundreds of poems, songs, letters on themes that really appealed to a universal audience, and themes of humanity, of love, some of it very scathing religious and political satire, but nonetheless very relatable and very humorous. And he is, of course, the author of that famous universal anthem, Auld Lang Syne.
Yes, indeed. So everyone, even if they don't know Burns, they know a bit of Burns. I think that's fair to say.
Absolutely the case. In fact, there are more statues or public memorials to Robert Burns worldwide than any other author. And there are several in Australia.
I must admit, I didn't know much about the Burns Supper. What is a Burns Supper and what's involved in it?
So the first Burns Supper took place on the 21st of July, 1801, and it was a small group of nine acquaintances and admirers who gathered together to commemorate Burns's death by reciting his poetry and song, by toasting him with a good Scotch dram, and by enjoying the humble meal of haggis, which of course Burns elevated in his poem to a haggis. But they quickly decided, given Burns's fame, which was already huge by this point, just 5 years after his death, that they should move this to the 25th of January as a celebration of his life. And it's become a really important way in which Scottish culture and Scottish tradition has spread across the world, as the Scottish diaspora have taken Burns and the Burns Supper with them when they've moved away from the country.
So what do you eat in a Burns Supper, and what's the typical order of proceedings?
So what we find actually is that the Burns Supper is evolving. It's a great example of living heritage. So people adapt the Burns Supper, but the original tradition was that it would commence with the Selkirk Grace. Some hae meat and canna eat, but some would eat that want it. But we hae meat and we can eat, and say the Lord be thankit. So it begins with the Selkirk Grace. There are always a series of toasts as part of this supper. The immortal memory of Robert Burns is all about Burns's life and work, and it's usually quite a reverent speech. And then we have the more humorous speeches that some will incorporate, the toast to the lasses and the reply for the lasses. But of course, at the core of any Burns supper is Burns's own writing. And we have to a haggis, that humorous address to the what is now the Scottish national dish. And that is, of course, what people eat at Burns Supper. Haggis, neeps and tatties, or haggis, turnips and potatoes. It usually ends, of course, with everyone joining hands and singing Auld Lang Syne.
I bet it does. And I bet sometimes people can't exactly remember how it ends. But it sounds like a fantastic night. Now, I'm interested by the addresses to the lassies and the responses from the lassies, because that, I suppose, raises what's a potentially thorny issue, which is sexual relations and Robert Burns. Is that somewhere you're willing to go?
Of course. So it's well known that Robert Burns had a very colourful life. He died at the age of just 37 years old, and he left us this phenomenal and huge legacy of writing, but he also fathered at least 12 children with at least 5 women. And the other thing we see is that in his writings, women are very much Burns's muse. They inspire him a great deal. He writes some of the most sublime love song, but he also writes some really explicit bawdry as well. And so Burns's writings about women, his relationships about women, are one of the most sort of contentious, I suppose, aspects of his life. But it's also gone a long way towards fueling that fascination that people have with Robert Burns.
Burns wrote in Scots, which is a distinct language, different from English and Scottish Gaelic. Could you speak a little bit more about that and how significant a figure Burns is just in terms of the Scots language?
So Burns is really very, very good at writing in both Scots and in English. But notably, his first printed and very celebrated collection of poems, we refer to it as the Kilmarnock edition, was titled Poems Chiefly in the Scots Dialect. It was the language he spoke and lived every day, and you do see that he's extremely comfortable and very, very creatively fruitful writing in the Scots language. In the early days, in the late 18th and 19th century, he was much celebrated by the Edinburgh literati, by the famous and Enlightenment authors of the late 18th century. But some of them were very keen to encourage him to try writing in English because they felt that this dialect was somewhat, you know, provincial, or that to be taken seriously as a poet, that he should be writing more in English. He actually resisted this to an extent. So what we have is Burns's commitment to writing in the language that he held dear and that was a part, as I've said, of his everyday life and the way that he saw the world and the way that he expressed himself.
On Sunday Extra, we're speaking with Professor Pauline McKay, Professor of Robert Burns Studies and Cultural Heritage at the University of Glasgow, ahead of the Burns Suppers that'll be taking place around the world this evening. Pauline, Burns is such a venerated figure that after his death, the term Burnamania was coined all the way back in 1811 to describe what at least Reverend William Peebles described as the sort of insanity that can surround Robert Burns. It's also true to say, I think, that the reputations of dead white men have been known to change over time. If it doesn't pain you too much, I wonder if you could run us through some of the main critiques of Burns as a man, a writer, and indeed as a national icon.
So it is the case that quickly following Burns's death, as I said, his fame, it became astronomical. And this was because of the way that people engaged with his writings, of course, and it was because he was quickly hailed up as the Scottish National Bard, this very important Scottish cultural figure, and someone who the diaspora took with them. Burns was very clubbable. He was in a number of gentlemen's clubs during his time. He was also an active Freemason, and the Freemasons did an awful lot to transmit Burns's reputation throughout the 19th century by, for example, upholding the annual celebration of the Burns Supper as part of their own meetings, but also by raising funds, subscriptions, to erect those public memorials that I mentioned earlier on. We see relic hunters descend upon Burns's widow, Jean, to just take a little piece of material culture associated with Bard. So we get a sense of the veneration which people have for Burns, but also the proximity that they want to feel to this national icon. And before we know it, Robert Burns effectively becomes the poster boy for literary tourism in 19th century Scotland. So we don't just have the birthplace in Alloway, we have the Land of Burns, which takes us throughout Ayrshire, down into Dumfriesshire to Ellisland Farm, which Burns himself built later on in his life, to Dumfries House, where he died, over in Edinburgh, where he spent 2 years at the height of his fame during his lifetime. So we have the Land of Burns, and Burns's fame is just unbelievable in the 19th century. So Burnomania is absolutely a thing. But we also get this sense that those people who celebrate Burns in this ritualistic way, that there's almost like he's almost become a cult-like figure. Mm. And you'll see the phrase coined, the cult of Burns. So in the 21st century, we are still very, very keen to promote and to celebrate Burns as the great author that he is and as an important Scottish cultural figure and as a cultural figure that unifies people all over the world. But that doesn't take away from the fact that there are elements of Burns's writing or Burns's legacy or even the celebration of Burns that are contemplated as less palatable in the 21st century than they would have been in the 18th or 19th centuries. And that is to do with the perception of Burns's complicated perspectives or relationships with the opposite sex, some of his very complex and at times contradictory politics mean that he can be appropriated or has been appropriated for just about any political agenda. And also his difficult relationship to religion, a profoundly religious man who couldn't really live according to the ideals of strict sort of Presbyterian religious orthodoxy in the 18th century. And this means that there's plenty of controversy for people to take a hold of and to explore. And we might also contemplate, obviously, the well-known fact that Burns, at a very difficult time in his life, contemplated a move to the West Indies to take up the role of a clerk on a sugar plantation. But he didn't in the end go. And we see this is something that scholars engage with regularly, and it plays out in the press and in the media each year.
The poet Victoria McNulty's said that she can't help but feel that if Burns was alive today, he'd rally against the cult of personality surrounding his name, just as he satirised those in power within his lifetime. What are your thoughts on that observation, Pauline?
Now, as with any component of Burns's life and works, I think that's a very valid point, but I also think you could argue the opposite. Robert Burns was a crafted, very carefully crafted, his literary persona. We see this in the prefaces to the Kilmarnock and Edinburgh editions of his poems, chiefly in the Scottish dialect, where he is leaning into the idea that he is a rustic bard, that he is the heaven-taught ploughman, and that he has this innate genius. And he promotes that. He's actually a master of self-promotion. Anecdotally, it's said that when Burns went to Edinburgh to promote himself as a poet, that rather than adopt the fashion of the time, the city fashion of the time, that he would go around in his boots and his breeches. He was really playing up to it. Burns was very concerned with his memory and with the memory of other authors. There's a song called Rantin' Rovin' Robin in which Burns commemorates his own birth. It begins, "The monarch's hindmost year but ane was 25 days begun. 'Twas then a blast of January wind blew Hansel in and Robin." That's the opening stanza. This is a song that's not very popular now, but it was very popular in the 19th century for people commemorating Burns. He's commemorating his own birth. He also commemorated the literary figure Robert Ferguson, another really gifted Scottish poet, tragically died at the age of 24 and very influential for Burns. And he was buried in a pauper's grave in the Canongate Kirk in Edinburgh. And Burns applied to the Baileys of Canongate Kirk and asked at his own expense to erect a tombstone over Ferguson's grave. And the words that Burns inscribed in that tombstone are all about directing pale Scotia's way to pour our sorrows o'er our poet's dust. Burns was interested in memorialising cultural and literary figures. he did a little bit of the memorialising himself in his own poetry, and I think that he would probably be quite chuffed.
I find you pretty convincing on that point, Pauline. And another one of your areas of expertise is intangible cultural heritage, which is something very hard to quantify. But I'd be interested in your thoughts on the position that you believe Robbie Burns holds in today's post-Brexit Scotland, and in particular amongst young Scots.
So first of all, to explain intangible cultural heritage, this is a phrase taken from UNESCO's convention, and it's for safeguarding intangible cultural heritage. That means promoting the living heritage, rituals, practices, oral expressions, culinary, all of the things that aren't material objects. It's living heritage. And Burns continues to be relevant in Scotland and, in fact, all over the world, because we ensure his relevance by persisting in this annual global celebration of Burns's works, by promoting his poems and songs, by continually engaging with those aspects of his life that are either inspiring or controversial, by contemplating what we can learn from Burns's writing about his own time in the context of the 18th century in terms of religion or politics or even the environment, and thinking about what that tells us about our own circumstances or what we might learn or how we might use the past or cultural memory to engage people in conversations about our cultural present. We ensure Burns's ongoing relevance through this, and also through the annual celebration of the Burns Supper, which is, as a social practice, one of the best examples of intangible cultural heritage, or living heritage, as we also call it, to come out of the United Kingdom. It's living.
Yes, indeed. So with that in mind, Pauline, do please tell us about your Burns Supper at 225 Years research project.
So the Burns Supper at 225 Scottish Tradition Global Reinvention project is looking to create a new updated inventory of the celebration of Burns Suppers worldwide. We want to plot this on an interactive map and support the global community of people celebrating the Burns Supper to share information with one another. But we also hope that this will underpin an application to have the Burns Supper listed, firstly in the UK, as living heritage. And we hope that eventually it will be listed by UNESCO alongside, for example, Italian food or the Mexican Day of the Dead.
Well, I will drink and eat haggis to that, Pauline. Sounds like a great idea. How can listeners who might be getting involved in their own Burns Supper this evening get involved in your project?
So if you're hosting or attending a Burns Supper, we'd really love to hear which poems and songs feature as part of your celebration. What are you eating? What are you drinking? What are you wearing? Do you have any innovations? Are you celebrating Burns in a multicultural way? Do you have any new recipes that you would like to share? And we have a survey that you can access on the Centre for Robert Burns Studies website, where you can send us this information along with any photographs or videos. And we will be delighted to share this with this global community on an interactive map to be launched on the 21st of July this year, which is, of course, the very day on which the first ever Burns Supper was celebrated.
Fantastic. Well, we'll share a link to the survey on the Sunday Extra website as well. And Pauline McKay, thank you so much for joining us. It's been fantastic speaking with you about Robert Burns and the Burns Supper.
Thank you, and happy Burns Night.
That was Pauline McKay, Professor of Robert Burns Studies at the University of Glasgow. And as I said, we'll put a link to Pauline's Burns Supper project on the Sunday Extra website.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.